Hey there, Yag here. Before we go on to today's episode, I would like to share with you an amazing podcast that I came across recently. The Salesman Podcast, hosted by Will Barron, brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network. If you work in sales, want to learn how to sell, or discover the latest in sales news, check out the Salesman Podcast, where Will helps sales professionals learn how to find buyers and win business in a modern, effective, and ethical manner. In fact, the recent episode on sales effectiveness was one of my personal favorites. The episode goes on to throw light on how sales effectiveness boils down to better alignment across the org. To be specific, it talks about how better alignment can improve your deal closure by 67%. So once again, I highly recommend you to give the Salesman Podcast a listen wherever you get your podcasts. And now to our show.
Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world.
Hello and welcome to another brand new episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. And this is me, your host, Yag. In today's episode, we are going to discuss how the role of marketing evolves from the first year of a startup to how it looks somewhere around the 10 million ARR mark. And to talk about this and share his insights, today we have with us Karthik Sridharan, the co-founder and CEO of Flexible, an online curated freelancing platform that empowers and connects companies and freelancers. Karthik is also the co-founder of Remote Tools, the fastest growing online community that focuses on featuring some of the best remote-first tech stack used by actual remote teams, and also shares insightful reads on the future of work, among many other exciting things. And it doesn't stop there. Karthik also co-founded the Remote Clan, a community for remote workers to build a strong career with the help of those who are pursuing the same goals. If you're on Twitter and follow tweets and threads around startups, chances are you might have come across some of his viral tweets. And if you aren't following him yet, I would highly recommend you to follow him on Twitter at KarthikS2206, that is KarthikS2206. With that, let's get to Karthik. Karthik, welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you here.
Hey, thanks a lot. Great introduction. Very kind introduction at that. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm super excited. Right, let's get started. You know, I've been a startup marketer all my life. And for most companies that I've worked for, I have been the first marketer on board. And the most tough and fun part of that game is it's about helping the startup to get their first million. So taking a leaf out of my peer podcaster in the HubSpot network, Sam Parr, who is known for Hustle and his podcast, My First Million, I would like to ask you this, you know, can you tell us a little bit about how long did it take Flexible to get to its first million? And more specifically, if you can throw light on this from the perspective of marketing.
So it did take us a while. It took us about 3.5 years or so. And it was a journey of uncovering various different things. It was initially trying to understand how we need to approach our customers. We built a product, which then we had to throw into the bin a couple of times, then used Google Sheets itself to get our first $100,000 in revenue. And the way we were able to identify customers then was to just use LinkedIn, you know, leverage our personal network, largely by identifying the kind of companies we want to be working with.
Right.
And then using our network to identify who was working in those companies and who could possibly connect us with the relevant person in that particular company. So that worked out for the first $100,000. But we recognized also the fact that our typical target audience was not in India, but was in the US, maybe in Europe, and certain other parts of the world where our personal network was not really deep. So just using LinkedIn and doing that was not going to work for us. So we had to figure out some other channel, and that's where marketing came in. And this seems like an afterthought, and frankly, marketing was an afterthought, which is a very big mistake for us. But we were first-time entrepreneurs with no background in marketing whatsoever. So initially, it was all about product hunt for us. So we uncovered that particular platform. It seemed like a gold mine for us at that point of time. We launch, we get leads. So not only did we launch Flexible, but we also made various different small side projects, which we felt would be helpful to our end customers, whether it's a company or if it's a freelance developer or a designer. We started making those small side projects, and it was successful to a certain degree, till, as you would know, Product Hunt is unreliable to a certain extent. And we recognize, so we recognize that we can't completely depend on that. But it did help us to grow from that 100K to maybe 3x that, of course, apart from the other channels that we were getting leads from. So I think at that point in time, to find more reliable channels, since we are a bootstrap startup, we couldn't immediately start investing heavily into paid ads. So we started reading a little around SEO and started investing small amounts of money in Google Ads as well. So Google Ads was a failed experiment for us. We spent around 6 to 8 months and recognized that our particular industry, the CPCs are very high, and expecting success at the budget that we had at that point in time was not something that would be achievable. So we thought of revisiting Google Ads when we would have a much higher tolerance for the amount of money that we could burn in that particular channel. Right. So we started investing a lot more into SEO. We had the stomach to wait it out, because SEO, of course, takes time. Since some of the other channels were helping us grow and also keeping us afloat to a certain degree, we felt that that is some bit of luxury that we had. So SEO is what we invested in. We started also looking into some other relevant communities like Indie Hackers, Dev.2, some subreddits. So started making very specific side projects instead of very small ones, one big one which can make a much bigger impact. So we made Scale, which offers free illustrations for startups or anyone across on the web for no cost at all. So all these kinds of things. So this got us to around, I think, $700,000-$800,000 in revenue. And that's where, apart from SEO, which was slowly starting to kick in, we also recognized that being a bootstrap startup, we need to own our own story, because we don't get easy PR.
Tell me about it.
So, but we weren't very social people, to be very honest. We made our account on Twitter only in early 2020, and LinkedIn was a very, you know, inert account that we had. So, but we recognize that we have to do it. So Rishikesh and I actually started investing in social media as well, to just tell our story, share what we have learned in the 4 years of existence, especially owning it from the fact that we bootstrapped it. We are largely organic, no paid ads whatsoever. So all of these kinds of things, it really sort of clicked, and we were able to reach our $1 million mark. And from there on, we have really shot up, and we have really grown to a much greater and higher growth rate in the last year and a half.
Right. So would you say it was about like 3 years or 4 years to get there?
So yeah, absolutely. As I said, I think the first 1 million was around 3.5 years of time.
Got it.
But then going from 1 million to around more than 3 now, it's taken us only a year or year and a half since.
That is amazing. And the thing about your social presence, it's now unbelievable to think that way, because when anybody is following on topics related to startups, it's hard to not stumble upon some of your tweets. So kudos to what you've done there.
Thanks so much, Yak. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And if you can also take us through your journey a little bit as to how your marketing approach, like you spoke about some of the things that you did to get to 1 million, but what was the marketing approach change that happened from 1 million to, quickly getting to 3 million plus? So what were the things that you changed? Maybe something about the kind of roles that you hired for, or the rationale behind each of those roles that you were looking for at that time?
So actually, marketing is one of the poorly staffed functions in our startup even today. So it's largely been me getting a bit of, help from Rishikesh and sometimes someone else in the team, right? So, and they are not entirely focused on marketing. So it's largely been a one-person job till earlier this year. And then this year, we got someone to help us a bit on product as well as marketing. So I wouldn't say hiring has been a driver of that particular change, but it's been the way we've known about SEO. I think SEO really, so when we started SEO about a couple of years back, the traffic that we got on our website was around 4,000 visits a month. And now we are at around 350,000 visits a month, right? So it's really grown in the past couple of years. Yeah, and we've sort of understood how to really leverage that particular channel, how to identify the right kind of keywords, how to, you know, build our authority in a non-spammy way to be able to, you know, write the kind of articles that get ranked, but also add value and convert. And even the pages that we write our articles on to make them highly converting as well. So all of these kinds of things. So, and even in that, we have identified keywords which are maybe typical marketer lingo, top of the funnel, high volume, but very low conversions. But that sort of gets our brand name out there. But then very low keyword volume kind of keywords, but they are very specific and convert really very, very well.
Got it.
So SEO has been, of course, very big part of it. But I think, as you would know, SEO takes time.
Yeah.
Right? So I think, so from 1 million to 3 million, it's just that point of time where SEO started really accelerating. But at the same time, it's also the time where our social presence also started growing and we understood what kind of narrative works. And it sort of tied with our personality as well, because we couldn't be someone who could keep sharing personal nuggets, but someone who could share our startup experiences. So we understood that people valued that. And sharing that was, you know, really working on social media as well. So these two channels really worked. Of course, apart from the fact that our own customers keep referring other customers. So these three channels have largely got us to where we are today in a very short period of time.
Right, right. And when it comes to the content that you spoke about, you know, I was anyway going to ask you about, was it the high volume keywords or was it long tail? Which you answered.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, you know, because this is a problem that a lot of content marketers might want to solve for, what was the game changer? Was it like, you know, the distribution that changed the increase in traffic, or was it about writing in third-party sites and getting backlinks? So what was the game changer there? Of course, you know, it's about the top of the funnel things as well as the long tail. But what actually drove the traffic?
So I think it's anyway a multivariable thing, right? I'm not sure we can entirely attribute to just one thing, but when we started off, I think our authority was pretty despicable, right? It was very low. And the problem started from the fact that I didn't know such a thing called authority even existed. So Uncovering SEO told me that, and I found that the best way to get backlinks was not, because if you search the web and they'll tell you 150 ways of getting backlinks from everyone. Right. So it gets really tricky, but I felt in the very early stages, and even now, the best way to get backlinks is through guest posts. Right. So I wrote a lot of guest posts, and that got us from an authority of around whatever 14 or 16 that we had to around 40, right? Which was a more respectable number. And thereafter, once we got to 40, I stopped focusing as much to increase our reputation and get in from a focus of getting backlinks to a focus of now saying, okay, now we need to have a lot of good quality keywords that we target and have content on our website for that. So identifying the right keywords for us to rank and the right kind of pages to make for that. So for example, what I mean by that is when we're making very top of the funnel kind of keywords for them, we write blogs and articles, right? And we've recognized that they're very generic because we are now not targeting an action by that particular target audience, let's say a developer or a company, but we're just helping them with whatever problem they might face. So a developer, it might be a technology-related article. For a company, it might be general hiring-related stuff, but not necessarily a company which is indicating that they want to hire.
Right.
So those would all be blog-driven. But identifying those keywords was, we found a replicable way of identifying those keywords. And for really highly converting long-tail keywords, we recognize that we need to have landing pages. And even those landing pages rank because they're low volume, but they don't have too much of competition on those. So it's better to sell your offering on that particular set of keywords rather than generically giving them article related information, you know, blogs and stuff like that. So I think it's been two or three part. One is being able to build up our authority through backlinks, and for which guest post was the best part of it. Second was being able to identify the right set of keywords for which we were able to find a proper replicable process by using Ahrefs. And third is being able to identify the right mode of content, whether it's a landing page or whether it's a short or long form blog or article.
You know, this is amazing. I've spoken to a lot of content marketers. I've spoken to a lot of different people. But, you know, this is by far the most practical and very realistic and honest definition, or probably a blueprint that you have given us. That's really fantastic. I really appreciate you for that.
No, it helps, given that I was an absolute noob. So I never tried to overcomplicate things. So even today, a lot of the times when people share jargons, you'll find me Googling to understand what that jargon means. So it's just trying to understand the very core principle and, you know, work it for our advantage. So that's been our way of going about marketing.
Yeah, absolutely. As they say, you know, it's a mark of a charlatan to complicate simple stuff and mark of a genius to do it the other way.
Let's hope I live up to the word genius, because I think I've got a huge part to work there. Yeah.
And, you know, clearly you built a remote first company much before COVID. And in fact, I've also been working remotely on and off since 2016. And very realistically speaking, while I still would never like to go back to working at a physical office anymore, there are definitely some missing nuances when we work remotely. So can you share some of your learnings when it comes to leading remote teams? What are some common mistakes to overcome, and how do you build a sense of camaraderie amongst teams when everybody is working remote?
No, it's a process which even I'm learning, so I would not claim to be an expert in this field. But the very core part of it is that we are so ingrained in a very traditional workspace of being next to each other, that when we become a remote company, we just try to recreate the same experiences over there, right? So right. If, you know, a lot of teams have seen, they're always on calls because they want to see their faces. They want to always chat with each other instead of maybe documenting things and sharing it over text. And so I think the underlying symptom or the underlying reason that might be guiding all of that is the fact that they just are recreating the in-office environment. So firstly, owning the fact that you're a remote team is very important, right? Don't try to recreate the same in-office environment. So what we try to do in terms of actually owning that remote team is being very documentation first. So being very text first. So we hire people who are really good in communication, and very specifically written communication at that. So whenever you're communicating, whether it's on our Slack, you know, our chat tool, whether it's on mail or whether it's documenting it in Notion, we try to get people to document it very professionally and in as detailed format as possible, right? So even on chat, we tell them to be grammatically right, to not use typical WhatsApp lingo and be very cool about it, because we feel it starts slowly percolating into other parts of communication as well. So I think hiring people who want to work remotely and whose written communication is really good was one really important aspect of it. Even in documentation, what we try to do is, if there is any form of communication that is going to be relevant, not just for today or tomorrow, but for something that's going to be relevant for the company in a process setting perspective, and let's say in a longer duration of time in months, then that should not be something that should be exchanged over Slack. We tell them that should immediately be documented in Notion. So for that particular purpose, we actually don't take a premium plan on Slack at all. So if someone has made the mistake of not documenting on Notion, they actually lose that conversation altogether. So that's why that drives them to actually go and put it on Notion. So that's been another part of it. In terms of camaraderie, I think we try to push people to be extra nice when they're talking to people on Slack, because when you're talking to a person like we are now, or even better when you're in person, it's easy to understand the tone behind what they're saying.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Otherwise, it's really tough. So we encourage them, even though, like I said, no WhatsApp communication, but we still encourage them to put a lot of emojis so that the tone of the entire sentence is very clearly conveyed. right? And it's not left to the other person's interpretation. It can be very misinterpreted, and it's better to always err on the safe side. So I'll always say be very kind, and, you know, like, load it with emojis if you've got to, right? Like, apart from that, we have, bi-weekly calls where we get on, you know, some kind of very fun activities where we have quizzes, people share their, you know, we have some kind of very specific pictures shared by people, and they tell their stories on how they associate with that picture. In the last couple of years, we've not been able to do that, but we typically would like to have quarterly physical meetups. So that apart from the remote environment, people get to know each other even in a more one-on-one 3D kind of environment as well. So hopefully very soon, if COVID subsides completely, we should be able to get our team in a single space and start doing it. But those have been, I think, the very large players. We try to do some other small kinds of things around festivals and, you know, giving people some kind of bonus where they can gift other people or buy something for themselves to upgrade some other kind of skills that they have been looking to build for themselves. So all these kinds of things where they feel that this is not a very transactional relationship, but something where each one of us is actually working with each other to build a very long-term relationship and not just a transactional one.
I really love this. And if I have to pick one thing out of all the things that you said, the golden nugget was not to retry and recreate, what was happening in the physical world. I think that to me is the most important thing. Love that. And about, the roles of people that you said as part of that, you know, it makes me curious, and maybe I should ask you this. What do you look for when you hire a marketer? I'll be more specific. At this stage, I saw that you're hiring for a growth marketer and a VP of marketing. So what are the 2 to 3 must-haves that you expect in a VP of marketing in terms of, say, skills or experience or whatever it is?
So VP of marketing basically, you know, is a function where now the person is not only going to be building the marketing function as an individual contributor, but is going to build a team that can have processes in place such that it can not function just for the next 6 months, but for the next 5 years, right? So you want a person who understands marketing. So the way, whenever I have conversations with people for this particular role, I'm looking for some kind of domain expertise where they have hands-on experience in any one particular channel of marketing and where they have actually gone and gotten their hands dirty, as they say, right?
Yeah.
In uncovering various different small nuggets. So in conversations, I'm trying to see if they're able to give an insight which I, as a person, as a marketer, find really fascinating, right? And I would know that this person has actually gotten into it and, you know, gone hands-on to be able to achieve that. So some bit of hands-on expertise in at least one channel of marketing. Thereafter, also look at whether they're really enthused about marketing. And so the way I try to understand that is if they're going out of their way to keep themselves updated on what's happening in the marketing world. Because like the typical tech world, I think marketing is ever changing. There is always new things to learn. So even if their focus has been, let's say, in organic, are they, you know, moving into paid and trying to just learn, read up about it, what are the kind of things that they listen to, or how do they keep themselves updated? So those are the kinds of things that I try to see from a perspective of how interested they are in marketing as a function. And third is largely from general smartness perspective, whether they're able to understand and deconstruct a business, because I think marketing is, you know, not just about understanding the channels, but understanding how the channels can cater to the core business, right? So whether they're able to deconstruct a business and say, okay, now I understand the business and these are the channels and this is the way this particular channel will serve this business. So the business understanding is really very important for me. And finally, I think the ability to really engage with people, right? So because as I said, it's about building a team, yeah, not being an individual contributor. So someone who can build a particular team from a perspective of hiring the right person, but also training them. So I think some of the earlier mentioned personalities help in this particular function, because personally, I always like to see leaders leading by example. So if they do the previous three things well, I think it would help in this fourth trait as well. So this is what I'm trying to gauge in a conversation.
With that, let's take a minute and talk about time. We are getting close to the end of the year. Sales teams may be thinking, what's in the next year's pipeline? Marketing might be taking time off. And there may be changes in how your customers are spending their time too. HubSpot wants to help you be efficient with your time while helping your customers feel valued for theirs. In fact, HubSpot has rolled out a ton of new tools that help your business deliver the best experience possible for your customers while being mindful of changing priorities with your sales teams. New payment tools like native payment links and recurring payments that directly embed in HubSpot's quoting tools and emails mean seamless delivery and payment collection. And now, with a CRM-powered CMS, your marketers and developers can personalize the customer experience and ensure that the attention that your customers give you is reflected back at them in data that delivers the best value for their time and attention. Learn more about how HubSpot CRM platform can help build, maintain, and grow your customer relationships at HubSpot.com. Yeah, this is very interesting. In fact, I work for a company called Avoma, and my CEO tells me this one thing. He says that, hey, Yag, make sure that we hire A players, because once you start hiring B players, they will start hiring C players. So that's not what you want.
No, I totally agree. And it's something that even I'm learning. And hiring as a function is something that over the last 6 months, I have taken on myself as a priority. So I think your CEO has nailed it. So now, earlier, possibly I would have made certain compromises on certain fronts, saying, okay, we are a small company, we possibly can't match market rates and so on. But now that we are able to pay people what they deserve and what we feel. So I think we are very particular about the kind of people joining us, and it just takes one person to totally destroy the kind of culture you're trying to build.
100%. Yeah. And here's one more key phrase that I often see in the startup world. I mean, this might bring a smile on your face. You know, the word scale, it's just kind of used too often, especially in the world of SaaS. And I remember one of your tweets where you said, scale for startups is relative and not absolute. And I would absolutely love it if you can expand a little bit on it. I mean, given the set of things that you have learned by building flexible ground up, can you maybe give us a perspective on how one should go about building their product for scaling up? At what stage should you think about scaling?
I think it's there all in the first statement, right? Because I think scale is not absolute, it is relative. So I think you should always think of scale. But the way you think, like most people think of scale, is just wrong. As in, when they think of scale, they're always thinking of a million users, right? So I think when you have just got an idea and you're just about building a startup, scale for you is getting that first customer.
Right.
Because that itself is not as easy as you think it is, right? So solve for that. Then if you've got one customer, scale for you is 10. And so typically I like to think of it in order of magnitudes, right? So 10 and 100 and then 1,000 and 10,000 and so on. So why I think of it in that fashion is that the kind of problems that you have to solve at each of these levels is very different. So if you try to predict the problems that you're going to be solving three order of magnitudes above where you are today, you are possibly not going to be solving for the right problems and are also doing a disservice to the problems you're facing today.
Right.
So your 100% focus needs to be to get your startup from today's scale to the next level of scale. Then solve the bottlenecks that you're facing at that point in time. So from a product perspective, I'm not saying do not have a vision for your product such that it breaks down when you just have, let's say, 1,000 users. But I would rather that you think of that particular problem when you have reached that level of scale, rather than thinking of it when you have not, you're still at your idea phase and you discourage yourself by saying, okay, I don't know to code, or I know to code, but building this product is going to take me 12 months and I can't invest that amount of time. I would rather that you build something that can get you to 10 users. And then you start thinking, okay, now this might possibly not work at 1,000 users. Okay, but maybe now let me start thinking of that problem once I am somewhere near the 100 user mark. So for example, for us, we did the exact same mistake. So it's not that I nailed it when I did it the first time. Right. So we built a product assuming that we'll get millions of freelancers and so on and so forth. And no one registered on our platform, or very little did, right? And what we recognized is that at the very core, what the company and the freelancer wanted was, the company wanted great talent, freelancers wanted great companies. They didn't care whether they were given that experience through an amazing product or not.
Right.
So we just used Google Sheets to get to our first $100,000, right? Yeah. Manually did everything till a point where, you know, Google Sheets was not sustainable anymore. Just sending mails to them individually was not sustainable. So I started just using Airtable, set up a few automations through Zapier, and automated a lot of the things that got us to, let's say, around 400 or 500K. So at that point of time, certain other things started breaking in terms of recommendations and so on. So I wrote a few scripts on Airtable, which got us to a little above a million. So thereafter, now we have a product which streamlines it further. But again, it's still on no code. We have it on Bubble, but we've still built it from a perspective, and that still is not a bottleneck for us today. So just because the world says no code can't scale, I will not agree with them and start, you know, building a code product. So it still has to be for us to think about whether I can get from 3 million to 10 million without using code. And I think the answer is yes. So I'll still stick to it. If at 10 million, I feel from going from 10 to 100 is going to be a problem with no code, at that point in time, I'll start thinking of how to start infusing code and how to build a product around that. So that's where I think scale has to be thought of in a relative format. Otherwise, you'll always be solving for the wrong problems and not the right problems that are relevant to you at that point in time.
Right. So here's why I asked this question. You know, maybe I'll put it this way. Does the approach change if you were not bootstrapping versus if you were actually raising a capital? Because like say, when you look at platforms like TikTok, for example, you know, from day one, they are not going to be profitable, but they are building it for scale to have millions and millions of users on a daily basis. So I know I'm comparing a B2C example, but still, you know, I'm asking, if it's venture funded, does the approach change?
No, it definitely does, I guess. I think the difference between bootstrap companies and venture funded companies is that there is a new stakeholder added onto the table, right? Which is the investor.
Yeah.
So you're now not only pleasing your core stakeholder, which is the customer, but now you're also doing things to please your investor. So in that case, I think if I were to tell my investor that I'm, you know, building a business on Google Sheets, I don't think anyone is going to be happy about it. So right. I think at that point in time, you have got to do things that is going to please your investor as well. So if we had raised funds, we actually built two failed products before we started with Google Sheets. So I think we would have built 10 more failed products and would have tried to force fit the product way of growth instead of just finding the right, like what I feel is the right way to just do what is needed to get revenue moving, solve your customer's problem, and try to figure out how to solve those bottlenecks as you start encountering them. So that's the way, but I think there is a distinction to be made here. There are two kinds of startups, largely, if I have to be very simplistic about it.
Yeah.
One is a tech-enabled startup, and then there is a core tech startup. So tech-enabled startups are basically startups like Uber, Swiggy, like food delivery startups and so on. Typically, those that to deliver their offering, they do not need tech. But to scale their offering, they need tech. Right. So scale in the way it's used generically. Right. So
yeah.
I think such tech enabled startups shouldn't be focusing on their product at the word go. They should focus on a solution that solves the core customer problem and then use tech to scale it. Right. You don't want to scale a solution that doesn't work.
Right.
But in terms of a core tech startup, maybe tech is something that's unavoidable. In that case, you possibly build, as has become very commonly used, an MVP, and in that case, define the MVP as bare bones as possible.
Right.
Right. So for a TikTok, understand, remove every feature apart from the feature that you think is going to really drive the startup for customers to just come and enjoy it. Of course, the standards in B2C have really increased, and what can be considered an MVP is really ridiculous right now.
But right.
I think it's a consequence of huge amount of VC investments in those sectors. So, but yes, I think the distinction between core tech startups and tech-enabled startups is really important, and you need to truly identify to your own self which particular startup you are, and then accordingly do what needs to be done.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Right, and as we are heading towards the 30-minute mark, I'm going to now switch to the next section of the podcast, mm-hmm. which we call the rapid-fire section. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to do is shoot 5 lightning questions at you. The questions might be short. Mm-hmm. The answers need not be.
Okay.
And let me see if I can try my best to put you on the spot. So are you ready for that?
Let's go.
All right. So here's question number 1. I hope to settle a controversy that's going around wild, especially on Twitter and LinkedIn. So what's the future of work? Is it going to be offices, or is it remote? Is it hybrid, or is it something else that I'm currently not aware of?
I think it's going to be a mix of everything. I don't think any one particular vertical is going to win.
Right.
Remote is definitely going to become a much more important player than it has been in the last 20, 30 years. It helps that you'll have new generations coming in where they would see remote as a common choice on the table and not something that is different or a new choice that is suddenly spotted out from nowhere. So technology is definitely going to help it. But I think there are going to be certain functions or certain industries rather where remote can't penetrate. So there you will still see in-person engagements being the norm. But a lot of the tech world is going to have remote, and that's the way it's going to grow. Hybrid setups might solve certain problems that remote might cause, because I think we are still very early in actually uncovering what the consequences of having a truly remote world might look like. So yeah. I think hybrid might solve it, but we might possibly come up with a recipe of remote that truly works, because today I think very few organizations actually have made remote work, and they are also pretty young in their journey. So when I say young, GitLab has been around for a while, but still it's still a 1,000-member team that's been around for less than a couple of decades. So we'll see how it grows, how it's able to handle a lot of different things. But I think it's going to be a combination of all the things. But remote is definitely going to play a very important part in it, at least in the tech startup ecosystem.
Yeah, I agree. And I also hope off the list, remote is the best place to go. In fact, I feel that hybrid can complicate the process further, because, there are going to be relationships that are well-built for the people in the office versus the ones that are working with them from a remote basis. So yeah, I think fully remote is where I would also side on.
No, I agree.
Right. So here's question number 2. This is something that you said I found both interesting as well as a little controversial. So I picked it up. Build B2C startups for fame and B2B startups for profitability. So can you expand on this?
See, of course, as in when you make one-liner statements, they don't tell 100% of the truth. But I think it fits the narrative of what's happening in the world right now. So I think B2B startups are easier to bootstrap, easier to make it be profitable, because I think companies as a customer are tougher to convince to shift to your brand or your startup. But once they do, they are more loyal, and they also pay money versus, I think, individual customers just expecting cashbacks and deals and those kinds of ways of engaging with you. So I think if you build something that's really valuable for a company, bootstrapping it or making it profitable is something that is very achievable goal. And there are a lot of B2B startups that you can quote as examples over here. But I think B2C is, as I just alluded to a little while ago, I think it's a particular sector that's been totally, for a lack of a better word, destroyed, I feel, because of a lot of VC investment going into that particular space. So yeah. Individual consumers like you and me have been totally spoiled, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Personally, if I buy from Flexible's perspective, where I'm a business buyer versus where I'm an individual consumer buyer, my mentality changes a lot.
Yeah.
Right. So if I don't get a cashback when I'm an individual buyer, I would immediately shift to a competitor. right? So I think it's really tough to build loyalty in end consumers. So it's an entire game of who has the deepest pockets. You have very vanity metrics in that particular sector. It's all about getting user growth rather than bottom line growth. And it's about all fighting, you know, winner takes all kind of markets, right? So
yeah, the Amazon game.
Yeah, Amazon also, you know, let's be fair, its B2C space even now just turned, I think, profitable a couple of years back. And AWS has been leading it, which is again a B2B space. Right. So
right.
I think that's where B2C is not a lot of fun, but it is what consumers identify with B2C brands. So that's hence I said popularity. But B2B startups actually can make money and can be profitable much quicker and can be sustainably built. And hence I said can align to profitability.
I love the reasoning. And in fact, the reason I use Zencastr for recording this podcast is because it's free. So absolutely.
I get what you're saying. Yes.
Right. So here's question number three. Mm-hmm. If you can answer this in just one line, you know, what's your strategy or content strategy for posting regularly on Twitter and crushing it? How are you able to crush it?
It's not a one-line answer, but I think it's very tough for me. As I said, I'm not a very super Twitter, social media kind of person. So I am very structured, unlike typically how people are supposed to use Twitter. So I keep documenting my thoughts. And when I'm supposed to tweet, I take any one of the thought that resonates with me on that particular day. And I try to write it in a way which would resonate with people out there. Because I think just sharing interesting thoughts is not enough. It also needs to be structured well. So yeah, that's typically how I go about it. I'm no Elon Musk, right, who has 50 million followers. So anything he writes goes viral. So I think it needs to be a lot more structured, especially for someone like me who's not very social media driven.
I love it. You know, one of the things that I really like about your tweets is it's simple and understandable. I know a lot of famous people who write one-liners, but it's very difficult to even understand what are they trying to say.
Yeah, they're too intellectually deep for us to understand, right? You can have an entire podcast trying to uncover what that line could have meant. Yes, it happens all the time.
Especially in the world of, you know, blockchain and crypto. I'm like, what are you guys even talking?
It's tough, yeah. But there are a lot of people out there, I agree.
Right. So here's question number four. What's your favorite story about a company finding their perfect freelancer or vice versa through Flexible?
I think we've worked with a lot of different companies. So I think my favorite would be very early on because at that point of time, I was personally involved in finding the freelancer, personally involved in convincing the company, seeing the kind of impact they're making firsthand as much as I could have possibly seen. So we had a few clients then. So let me just point out one. Plevo was a Y Combinator company, raised money from Andreessen Horowitz. So they've grown sustainably. They are a B2B startup competitor to Twilio. So they wanted to scale various different products that they were building internally, but hiring was not something that they were able to match up to the way the products were growing. So it was interesting for us to be able to find developers, not just in one tech stack, but we found developers in close to 7 or 8 tech stacks. And in a period of just about a couple of months, we had all of them already onboarded on projects and they started delivering really very well. And that project took off for Plevo. So it's really a lot of fun to see a company facing a challenge, which you then end up solving for them in a period of time that they themselves wouldn't have envisioned as being solvable. So that was something that I was personally involved in and I really enjoyed that entire
experience. And that too, when you have something like that happening in the, you know, early days of a company, it's far more satisfying.
Yeah, exactly. And we never had a company that hired so many developers. They ended up hiring more than, I think, 12 or 15 developers from us in that particular space, space of time in 2 to 3 months. So it wasn't something that we had experienced at all. So it was something which was super amount of joy. Of course, now it happens far more regularly for us. But at that point in time, it was something that I uncovered about the market, which I hadn't predicted at all. I didn't know that companies could hire at such a scale and we could impact companies at such a scale as well. So it was a really enjoyable experience.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Here's the final rapid fire question. And this is, again, I wanted to close with an amazing tweet of yours. So you said the beauty of the startup world is that 100 mistakes can still add up to deliver significant success. I love that, but you know, for the sake of the audience, I would really, really love if you can expand on that. I've gone through that in my current company, but yeah.
I think people commonly use mistake and failure synonymously.
Right.
Right. So I think mistakes is just going to be that, you know, very in a very cliched format, going to be that stepping stone towards success. Each mistake gives you that bit of progress in the right direction.
Yeah.
Even if it didn't give you all the 100% progress you expected, you know, that particular move of yours to make. That's why I never equate mistake equal to a failure. For example, if you go and decide to use SEO as one of your channels and you fail miserably, in the sense that, you know, typically the way fail is used,
yeah,
in the first month you get zero traffic, second month you get zero traffic. But in that period of time, you've understood what SEO is.
Correct.
You've understood the impact SEO can make. You might have made 15 mistakes on the way, but now you know 15 different ways you shouldn't have done
yeah.
it, and you've learned 15 new things. And that's definitely going to make a huge amount of impact in the next few months of delivering success for your particular startup.
Yeah.
So I think every mistake, and you need to make those mistakes, right?
Yeah.
It's not so much about not making mistakes that makes someone successful as much as recognizing them and correcting them. So it's all about, you know, I say it very colloquially in internally at Flexible. I say, be the shittiest form of yourself on the first day. Your goal is just to be less shitty the next day.
Right.
And keep doing that day after day after day till one day you realize that you become really good at what you do.
Right.
Right. And that's the entire process of building a startup. You don't become perfect on day one. You don't achieve success on day one. It's just that very beautiful journey of making mistakes, recognizing them, correcting them. And then after 100 mistakes, you realize you've already walked such a long path.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I was trying to say in that.
No, it's beautiful. I love that. And you know what? You hit all the 5 questions out of the park. I really, really enjoyed, you know, going through the rapid fire with you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed answering them as well.
Right. So before I, you know, say my thank yous and let you go, I want to ask one last favor.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a parting message that you would like to share with our audience, that would be fantastic. And let me set the context.
Mm-hmm.
Our listeners are predominantly SaaS marketers and salespeople in the B2B world with mm-hmm. at least about, 6 to 7 plus years of experience.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, giving SaaS marketers or salespeople any kind of technical advice is not really a great way to finish a podcast. So let me just give some kind of learning that I've achieved in terms of my life, right, around building career or a life. So I typically say, don't try to build a career, try to build a life, right? So optimize for those kinds of things. So whatever move everyone makes, I think it needs to be to optimize for their level of happiness. So if your current role is not giving you that, move to a different role. Be very experimental. Try to do things, make mistakes, enjoy them, laugh about them, keep sharing things that you, you know, all the things, whether it's bad, good, publicly. I think all growth is very uncomfortable, right, by definition,
yeah,
because you've never done that before. So optimize for happiness, keep growing. So I think it's going to be a wild ride, but don't settle for something that you're unhappy about today, just envisioning happiness in a fictitious future, right? So I think that's some parting message that I would like, you know, SaaS marketers, salespersons, anyone out there, because I think at the end of the day, we are people who are trying to be happy. So I think that's really helped me personally.
Yeah, I absolutely love that message. And the only thing that settles is dust.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I agree. Yeah.
Love it. And where can people find you, and what are the best reasons that they can connect with you for?
I think Twitter, I am very regular there. LinkedIn, I'm very regular there. I try to answer as many replies as come to my tweet, as well as DMs. And whoever reaches out to me, and I think it's better to converse over mail, I share my mail IDs with all those people as well. And I'm happy to share it here too. So I can be reached on karthik@flexible.com. So Twitter, LinkedIn, and mail, these three are the best places to reach me.
Amazing. And I can attest that I connected with Karthik through Twitter. And here I am after exchanging a couple of emails. And here we have this wonderful conversation. So Karthik, thank you so much. I love this, 40 minutes plus of conversation where you shared so many nuggets of wisdom across building a startup from scratch, the initial struggles, and there's so many thoughtful things that you've shared as part of your experience will surely help a lot of people who have listened to this episode. So thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for this opportunity, Yag. The questions were amazing. It made me think. So always enjoy doing that. And I really hope people find this useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And for the listeners, that's that from us in this episode. And until we connect with you the next time with another guest and another topic, this is bye from me, Yag. Have a good day and take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.